Take a walk on the paranormal side. Justin Bamforth back with us. His book, The Spectrum, which came out several years ago, is still out there. And we're going to be talking with him about all kinds of things when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me tell you about Justin Bamforth. He is an active investigator, researcher into really all facets of the paranormal, which include UFOs, mental phenomena, the men in black, and other areas of high strangeness. For close to two decades, he lectures on the subject regularly, along with consulting people across the planet to better understand whatever it is they're dealing with. He has written a book which came out in 2018 called The Spectrum. He was last with me, Justin, 2 years ago. How time flies, huh?
I know, right? It's like about a missing time.
It really is. How have you been?
Good. Holding up.
Super. How did you get involved in the strangeness of all of this?
Well, I think like so many of your listeners can attest to, you know, we don't really choose this field, right? It kind of like chooses us.
It picks
for whatever
us.
Reason.
That's right.
And the same thing happened with me. You know, I grew up in a haunted house, or rather like a haunted experience as a childhood. And that kind of first piqued my curiosity. And then I just started exploring it, researching it, and then eventually just investigating it for myself.
Have you found that people are more accepting of this, more willing to understand it than they were maybe 10, 15 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, with a lot of the success of the, you know, the paranormal TV shows out there, that's kind of helped to remove the taboo of the subject and, you know, encourage people to really talk about it. And then with what's happening in the mainstream media lately with the UFO, UAP subject as well. That has really helped a lot. So,
as an investigator, Justin, what have you concluded about all this? That it's, you know, definitely real, that some of it's real? What's your overall feeling?
I think there's a lot of it that is, I think, overlooked and not really understood in the sense of how it impacts and affects the experiencer themselves. You know, I think what we're dealing with here is, you know, it's as good as anybody's guess. You know, it's something that's been around since the beginning of mankind. And I don't think we're any closer to figuring out than we were back then. It's a perplexing field. It's a complex field. And I think there are also elements of trickster aspects at play. I think we tend to underestimate its ability and, like I said, overlook certain things that you know, we really should pay attention to.
Are we being set up sometimes by government, by agencies, like you said, to trick us, to really mislead us?
I think that might, you know, obviously that will be a possibility for sure. But I don't think it's quite that simple. To be honest with you, I think a lot of government agencies are just like us. They have no clue what's going on. And I think they're kind of looking to us, the public, to kind of help them piece together this puzzle, if you will.
Well, you wrote the book, The Spectrum, back in 2018. We had you on in April of 2019. But this book still holds its own, doesn't it?
I hope so. You know, when I set out to write this book, I really wanted to not really give people answers, but I wanted to kind of spark some questions, to kind of look at this phenomenon from different perspectives, to really, you know, look beyond the obvious and to look beyond what we think we know about how it operates and how it appears. That was my ultimate goal, and I've received a lot of positive feedback so far, so hopefully it's working.
That's good for you. I mean, you know, you have had a lot of people that have written you stories about their experiences after reading the book, haven't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I get a lot of people who contact me through my website, normalparanormal.org, and I get people from all over the world, from all different types of experiences, too. You know, not just paranormal, but UFO-related, cryptid-related, even just strange mental phenomenon. You know, it's really fascinating to hear the reports from people, especially if they don't even know how to classify it. You know, like if somebody has an experience with, say, like a doppelganger, who do you go to with that report?
Right.
You know, those are the reports I'm really focusing on.
Tell me one of your challenges of investigating, a story that you just have never forgotten.
Sheesh, there's been so many. I think the aspect that really kind of gets to me, I think, is when I think I've figured it all out. And then I'll hear of a case that'll just kind of like force me to do a complete like 180 with my thinking or with what I thought I knew. One of those cases kind of challenges our definition of a ghost. I love this case. I call it the Rhea Baker crisis apparition case, which I could share with you if you like.
Yeah, please.
So, when people think of ghosts, right, they think of, spirits of those who have passed on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this one woman who told me her story, her pseudonym is Rhea Baker. She actually is in the medical field, but she wanted to remain anonymous. At the time, she was doing a residency at a hospital up in Lehigh Valley, Pennsylvania. She was working the overnight shift. They brought a man in who had overdosed on heroin, and he was brought in completely unconscious. So they suspected that like this man had like had violent seizures. The way that first responders discovered his body, it was all like contorted, almost like a pretzel. She saw the man come into the ER, go right into surgery. Later that same night, Rhea was walking the floors. It was about maybe 1 or 2 a.m. and she noticed the same man out in the hallway. But this time, the man was just in a wheelchair and he was kind of staring down. She approached the man and she said, along the lines of like, can I do anything for you? The man just looked up at her, didn't say a word, and just shook his head. And then for some reason, Rhea simply patted the man on the shoulder and just walked away, which she admits is something she wouldn't have done under any other normal circumstances. And that's important. You know, normally she would have taken him back to his room, got another nurse to come assist.
Right.
Then 20 minutes later, she hears code blue. And to all of, the medical people who are listening to the show, you know that that's like a cardiac arrest alert. So the room number that she was called to, it happened to be the same room as the man she had seen moments prior in the wheelchair. She gets in there. But the thing is, according to his records, he never regained consciousness that night.
Oh, my God.
He also had both of his legs amputated at the knee and one arm amputated at the elbow. But when she saw him, he was completely intact.
Oh,
I know, right?
The spirit of the guy.
Yeah, and it kind of reminded me of like a crisis apparition, and those are typically reported when, an individual goes through something quite traumatic and someone else related to them or someone who knows them quite well physically sees them at a different location. And I always thought this was interesting, but it's not quite a crisis apparition because she didn't really know this guy, but he wasn't deceased. It's almost like an example of like bilocality, which is, another aspect of this. It's really bizarre, right?
Years ago, I'm taking open line calls, Justin, on a Friday night, and a police officer called the program and he said, I got to tell you this story that me and my partner were called to a house, that there was a heart attack victim and we got there before the emergency medical technicians even got there. So we get to the door. We knock on the door. A little old man opens it to let us in. We rush in there, and we see on the floor somebody on his stomach. And we figured, oh, my God, this is the guy dying of a heart attack. And, the EMT techs aren't even here yet. They roll him over. It's the guy who opened the door for them. That was his spirit. I mean, it happens all the time.
That is just so remarkable, right? Like things like that.
And these things are happening to people.
They are, yeah. And that's the other thing too, right? Like a lot of people ask me, well, do you believe these stories? Well, it doesn't matter what I believe. What I believe are the people telling me these stories.
That's right.
Because they were there. I was not. So I don't have enough information to disprove it, but I also don't have enough information to prove it happened. All I can do, take them at their word, but when you hear the tone in their voice, when you see the look in their eyes, when they're telling these stories, they're reliving these stories. And sometimes it's very troubling for them to just process.
You have investigated shared premonition phenomena. What is that exactly?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting aspect because, obviously people have premonitions all the time, but usually those premonitions are meant for themselves, right? In this case, I have a few examples, and one of them actually happened to me. I found myself, at a local cable provider, right? Now I was just really stressed out. I was returning a cable box, right? And I was on the phone with the representative telling, who was telling me one thing, and then
I hate those things.
Yeah, I know, right? And then, it was mixed messages back and forth in the call center and on the phone. Anyway, so keep in mind, I was very stressed out. And I think that's a key component to a lot of these experiences, is our mental state prior to them. Anyways, I was in the waiting room. I was really enraged, to be quite honest, especially at the lack of service. But anyways, I'm there, and someone comes in, and they're waiting at the front desk there, too. And then suddenly I got hit with a different feeling, and it was like an overwhelming sense of dread, of fear, like my car was about to be hit.
Really?
Specifically like that. And I thought to myself, well, that's impossible. I started going through like where I parked my car. It was a safe area. I specifically parked away from the road. And then just then another individual comes running in. He looks around. He comes in the room. He comes frantically to me. And he says, "Are you parked out here in the lot? I'm so sorry, but I totally hit your car."
Oh, my God.
Yeah, right? I'm like, "Are you kidding me?" And he describes my car at the time. And, he describes
a car.
Presumably my car. Yeah, a car. It's not mine, though. The other gentleman on the other side of the room, he hears this. It was his car. So it's like in that moment, like I was 100% sure that it was my car that got hit.
Why did the guy single you out in the beginning in the first place?
Your guess is as good as mine.
That's bizarre.
It very, very much so. And there was, it's interesting because there was a school teacher in Philly that I interviewed as well. And she had a similar thing where she actually had a dream where she was taking her 3-year-old son to preschool, but she was running late. And in the dream, as she brought him into the school, she realized that she left her pocketbook on the front seat of her car. So then she reaches her vehicle, and in the dream, she remembers being surprised to find it was still there. But she noticed that her purse had been torn apart, and her wallet was stolen. Then all of a sudden, she wakes up from her dream. So ironically enough, she wasn't running late, but she was certainly cutting it close. She's dropping off her son in preschool, basically the same type of dream situation. And as she approached her school then to work, she met another teacher walking up to the door. And all of a sudden, the other teacher looks at this teacher, and she goes, "Oh, crap, I left my phone right on the front seat of my car. My car is going to get broken into again." And then this one teacher then shares the dream with her and says, "Hey, don't worry about it. I'll tell them you're running late. Just go get your possessions." It's very strange. So it's almost like she had a premonition meant for somebody else as well.
What causes this connection?
I think stress is a key factor in a lot of these experiences. I think that's one element.
Both parties? They both have to be under that kind of tension?
That I don't know 100%, but I know that in a lot of the people who share with me their stories of these inexplicable events, I always ask what their state of mind is before the event, or what they can remember, what they can recall, and how they kind of processed it. And stress is one of those key components. And also this, it's strange because, like I mentioned with the Rhea Baker case, there's almost like this strange manipulation factor going on behind the scenes too. People are acting out of character. They're doing things they wouldn't normally do.
Right.
And it's not occurring to them as unusual until I bring it up. And I said, "Would you have done that under any other normal circumstances?" And they're like, "Wait a minute. No, I wouldn't have. That's really bizarre. Why did I do that?" So.
Well, I think what happened in your case with the car situation is you picked up on the guy who hit that car, and you were picking up his thoughts and, his panic as he's running into the building and everything else. And I think you probably picked that up somehow.
Yeah, that's certainly a possibility. I've had other experiences too that are along those lines. And again, why did I pick up this random stranger's thoughts? That I can't seem to figure out.
Of anybody out there, why him, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I kind of kick myself nowadays looking or thinking back on it. Like, I should have talked to that guy. found out what his story was, seeing if maybe our paths that kind of overlapped or crossed at some point, maybe we had a lot more in common than I would have realized. I don't know.
Fascinating indeed. Doppelgangers. What is your definition of a doppelganger? Yours?
Yeah, well, we all know the classic definition. With doppelgangers relating to what I've been researching is they seem to be taking on a form that, what should I say, it kind of like, I really don't know. I don't know how to describe it other than like it's like a carbon copy of somebody. But it doesn't necessarily have to be like a full-blown manifestation, right? They're just, it could be like a shadow that looks like them or has the same height and build. I get a lot of those cases. Let me share with you one particular case that really bothers me.
Okay.
This was with a couple in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, named Tina and Eric. And they were on a cruise ship. And, you know, a lot of these cruise ships are very, very small. You know, if somebody wakes up in the middle of the night, you're going to know it because the beds are very close to one another. But what was fascinating about this is Tina and Eric had a remarkable shared experience. What happened was Tina, the mom, she woke up by her son getting out of bed and proceeding to the direction of the bathroom. And she was getting ready to say something when she heard her husband, Eric, call out the boy's name and told him to lay back down in the bed. But this boy, he was actually not in the bathroom, but he was still in his own bed, and he answered back, much to both of their confusion and surprise. And when I first heard about this case, I had met them at a wedding, and I thought, okay, this is interesting, but I really want to ask the boy what was going through his mind at the time. So I, you know, found him at the wedding. I talked with him, you know, individually, and I said, hey, what do you remember about that night in particular, besides your dad waking you up? And I asked him if he was dreaming, and he said, yeah, I was. I was dreaming that I was walking to the bathroom, and then my dad wakes me up. So what's also fascinating about this is this family has had several other doppelganger experiences with this particular boy.
Isn't a doppelganger supposed to be almost like the exact duplicate of you, except that it's evil?
Yeah, exactly. Like, the classic definition being, you know, evil twin, right? And that you, if you see it, you're supposed to die. Well, lots of people see these doppelgangers, and nobody dies, at least that I'm aware of.
Right.
But it still blows our mind, for sure. And, yeah, and with Tina, when she saw on another occasion, she saw her son's doppelganger. She heard rustling around from the boy's room. She wakes up. She sees the boy walking down the hall. But just a shadow because it's dark, it prompted her to get up out of bed and chase after him, go down the stairs, call out his name, only to find out there's nobody there. So the boy has also had a lot of out-of-body experiences too. So is it himself, like, inadvertently projecting himself? Maybe a lot of these doppelganger cases are like that, right?
That could be very well. Justin, what's your website for folks?
It is normalparanormal.org.
I like that, normalparanormal.org. And the book, The Spectrum, is still available. I notice it's still on Amazon available.
Yeah, it sure is. It's and now it's available at some of your local bookstores, too. It's at Barnes & Noble as well. And there's a really great shop in New Jersey, in Mount Laurel, called On Angels Wings. They've been the biggest supporter of the book. I highly encourage them if you're in the South Jersey area.
When we come back in a moment with Justin Bamforth, we're going to talk about the multiverse theories, more messages from beyond, Men in Black, and some other strange things with UFOs in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Again, his website is normalparanormal.org. The book is called The Spectrum. We will be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie back with Justin Bamforth as we talk about the paranormal world. You've looked at multiverses. What do you think of that? I have my theory about deja vu, but what are your thoughts on the multiverses, Justin?
Yeah, the multiverse, you know, that's an interesting aspect for sure. You know, what exactly is the multiverse? You know, from what I understand, it's, you know, it's like if you make, you know, and those in the science field, you know, please correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is, you know, that there are certain choices we make, and when we make a choice or a conscious choice, it creates another you in another reality. And, you know, that other you makes choices, which makes other choices and creates other yous. And I've always wondered if maybe there's overlap, right, from this type of a theory. And maybe what we are seeing as ghosts are nothing more than those other yous or other people in other realms.
That's possible. I've always thought deja vu, that ability to think I've been here before, is that too, that just might be a few seconds out of kilter from another universe that we're matching ourselves in.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, there's, you know, again, there's so many different theories we can put on paranormal phenomenon or whatever we want to call this high strangeness. And it's like every theory is plausible. Every theory does have hold a certain weight. But, you know, sometimes when you hear these experiences, again, I just caution people, don't try to categorize it. Don't try to label it. Just take it for what it is. Write it down, most importantly, you know, log all the points of data and all that, because you never know when something seemingly unimportant will actually give us a clue or be very relevant to an experience.
How did you get involved investigating Men in Black stories?
Yeah, that seems to be a very popular subject that a lot of people are intrigued by. As much as, you know, I'd like to think that the typical Men in Black case involves, you know, black-clad individuals, you know, wearing the fedoras and the black suits and the sunglasses and all that.
Yeah.
The fact is, it just doesn't always happen that way. Yes, it can, but what I've found is I've started asking people about, have you ever had any odd encounters with odd individuals or people that just, you know, stood out to you as not really normal? In fact, while we were actually a couple hours ago before the show, I got an email from a gentleman who used to work out at Alcatraz Island.
Oh,
he was
geez.
Telling me about one such experience where these 17 guys showed up to take a tour of Alcatraz, and they all said that they were from AFOSI, you know, the Air Force Office of Special Investigations.
Mm-hmm.
But what stood out to him is that these individuals didn't say anything. They were just very robotic. And they were covered with bruises. And that is what stood out to them, or stood out to this gentleman. And he said, you know, there were no jokes, no talking, nothing. And, you know, again, if you're looking for a classic Men in Black, you're probably going to overlook some of these things. I think they're showing up as just presumably normal people, but they're trying too hard to fit in. So it's coming across as very unnormal.
Who do you think they are, or what are they?
Well, you know, this is a great question because my friend Daryl Sims, who is a pioneer in the alien abduction field, you know, I've asked him about this too, because I know he's done some research on this. He's had direct encounters as well with some of his abductees. But he thinks that there are two different types of groups of MIB, and I tend to agree. There's obviously the classic people from some alphabet soup government agency that's, you know, off the books, and that would explain some of the more human encounters. However, there are some experiences that kind of defy that, and you know, these individuals display very inhuman characteristics. Sometimes they'll just show up out of nowhere. They'll just disappear. How do you do that? I don't know. But sometimes in these really strange encounters, the individuals, they will almost like look, again, not quite right, like they're trying too hard to fit in. Sometimes
yep.
they won't have any hair or even pores on their skin. It's really bizarre stuff. Or like this gentleman who emailed me about Alcatraz, they'll seem very robotic. However, there is one common mannerism I've noted with these individuals. It's their movement. The way that they move is very mechanical, very stilted, or very like somebody described it to me as very like herky-jerky.
Like an android?
Yeah. Kind of, but like almost like somebody who, I don't know, has trouble or difficulty walking. And now I want to caution your listeners, that doesn't mean every single person you see out there who just looks a little off or may even have a physical disability is one of these odd individuals I'm talking about.
Right.
But there are certain things, certain aspects. For example, there was a lady from New Zealand who emailed me. She had contacted me about something else unrelated to the Men in Black. Well, 2 days, I think it was 2 or 3 days after she emailed me, she was out with her son jogging. And, you know, taking the dog out for a walk. And it's the same park that they go to all the time. And, you know, nothing was unusual. And then she noticed that there were two individuals that stood extremely close to one another, off in the distance. But the motion of their arms and legs did not match the speed that they were jogging in reality. And she said that their heads didn't bob up and down like they normally should do. Not to mention that each time she and her son stopped walking, these two joggers would suddenly stop advancing forward. It was like they were matching their speed or their movements. And the whole experience, you know, it really shook her up. And then she mentioned something to her son about it. And her son said, oh, yeah, there was another couple of joggers who were doing the exact same thing a few moments prior further back. Yeah, it freaked her out. And it really bothered her son. And then a couple days after that, they described that they had this dark cloud over their whole house and just overwhelming senses of fear and dread. And she was almost going to completely call off the interview with me. She was blaming me for being
down
there. So, but again, what is that? You know, typically these Men in Black or MIB experiences, I just call them, you know, strange people experiences.
Well, initially we thought, Justin, that they were government officials trying to scare people or get them to, you know, not talk about UFO encounters and things like that. It seems to have expanded into where these may be dimensional or ETs.
Yeah. Again, all these theories definitely hold weight. But like the phenomenon operates in such a manner that just when you think you've put your finger on it and you've figured it out, there'll be another experience or another report that'll come through that completely does the opposite of that. And it's like, well, that doesn't hold up in this case. What is this sort of stuff? And it doesn't just trail a UFO experience either. It can trail any sort of experience.
What stories have you covered with strange things from the other side?
Well, that's like things from beyond, like the afterlife, if
the
you will.
The afterlife.
Well, there was an interesting experience that was sent to me. Actually, it's the same couple, Tina and Eric, who had the weird doppelganger experience with their son. Well, about a month ago, Tina's mother had passed, and she had told her husband that a few months back she had a dream where she saw her mother in the dream. It was in May, and her mother, Geraldine, said very specifically to her, "You have 40 days." Now, Tina didn't know exactly what that meant, but she wrote it down on their calendar anyway, in case there was like some significance later on. Well, day 40 came and went. Nothing significant had taken place. But in the week since her mother's passing, Tina went to Target on two occasions to pay for items, and she was just randomly handed $40 in cash at the register. But the thing is, she didn't ever recall hitting the cashback option on either instance. And this happened twice. She still received the $40, nevertheless, and you know, when she returned a third time to return some other items, the cashier recognized her and, you know, said something to the notion of, like, I hope that same strange thing doesn't happen with the $40. Then her husband, Eric, was out walking, and he saw a random magnet on a vehicle. And it said, it was an anti-abortion sticker, but it said 40 days for life. And he felt it had some meaning, so he took a picture of it. Now, again, Tina suggested that Eric share all this with me at some point. And I'm glad he did, because I'm fascinated by these messages. But again, I try to approach it from a different angle, you know, and suddenly a thought popped in my head. What if Geraldine meant 40 business days instead of 40 regular days? Because the two of them, Tina and Eric, they're very, you know, they're business professionals and they operate on that type of schedule. Once I did the math, I realized that it put the date at exactly like when Geraldine passed, that 40 business days was exactly the night that she passed. And I'm willing to bet that Tina had that dream at exactly the right, or the exact same hour, too. So, and what's also fascinating is Tina has had an ability in the past to know the exact dates and times of when other people in her family would pass. That's another story, but it really freaked her out.
Wow. You've got a story about the late actor Telly Savalas, who had a very strange encounter in the New York area, I believe.
Yeah, absolutely. Up in Long Island, New York. This was in the late 1950s. You know, Telly, unfortunately, he is no longer with us, and I really wish I had the opportunity to ask him about some of these experiences,
right?
Because I think there's more to it than that, or than this, rather. So, short story, he ran out of gas. He made a trek to the nearest business to find out where the nearest gas station was. And as he's making this trek through the woods, he all of a sudden hears a high-pitched voice say, "I'll give you a ride."
Out of nowhere. Out of nowhere, yeah.
Exactly, yep. Just out of nowhere. And when he looked up to see where this voice was coming from, there's a man dressed in all white waiting for him in a Cadillac. And again, wearing an all-white suit. So it's almost like a man in white. Savalas says, again, he never heard the vehicle approaching when all of a sudden it was just there. Either way, he agreed. He gets in the car with the gentleman. They drive off toward the gas station together. Once they arrived, the man suddenly offered Savalas a dollar. Even though Savalas had never asked for any money, he still took the man up on the offer.
For gas, I guess, right?
Exactly, yeah. He didn't have any cash, and he was really embarrassed by it, too, because he did have a full-time job. So what he said...
And this is before he was the actor, right?
Yeah. This is the late 1950s. I think he was working for the State Department at that time. So he promised to mail the man back his money. You know, just give me your name and, you know, address or phone number, you know, and I'll get it to you. Anyways, the guy helps him out, puts gas, helps him fill up the container, helps him get it started. Then the man randomly exclaimed, "I know Harry Agonis, who was a baseball player back then." What was odd about it is they weren't talking about baseball.
He just popped up. Yeah.
It just popped up. Yeah, the man asked this. And Savalas then said, "Okay, well, who is he?" The guy goes, "A utility infielder for the Boston Red Sox." Okay, strange. Anyways, the night is done. He gets his car started. Anyways, it's the following day. After work, Savalas sees a headline in the Journal American, which read, "Harry Agonis dead."
Wow.
Right. It gets stranger. So then he thinks back of that guy, that man in white. He sees, you know, his name. He sees that the man's name is James Cullen, and there's an address and a phone number. So he calls the number. They answer. They say, "Oh, it's Jimmy's Bar." Savalas goes, "Okay, can I speak to Mr. Cullen?" Staff is confused. They bring somebody else on the line. This woman answers. And Savalas is like, "Hey, I'm just wondering when I can expect him because, you know, he lent me some money last night. I want to pay him back." And the woman's really angry, and she's like, "Look, I don't know who you're talking about, but you're talking about my husband, and he's been dead for over 2 years."
Oh.
Hangs up. Yeah. So then Savalas and this woman, they get together. They meet up. They compare the signature. It matches. The description that Savalas gives her of how he was dressed was exactly what he was buried in.
Did he have a Cadillac?
No, that wasn't brought up. But what was interesting was the high-pitched voice was brought up, and the woman said, "Well, actually, Telly, he has the same type of deep voice as you, but he killed himself with a gunshot to the throat right through the voice box."
Oh, my God.
Right. So, again, very, very strange. Well, about... maybe in 1963, November 1963, Telly Savalas is on the golf course with his buddies, and he hears the exact same high-pitched voice again. And the voice says, "Telly, did you hear what happened in Dallas?" And Savalas looks around at his friends, and he's like, "Did you hear that?" And they're like, "Yeah, we heard it, but we didn't understand what it said." Savalas is really shaken up. They play a few more holes. He's still bothered by this. So they take a break. They go into the golf club. They're watching TV. Walter Cronkite suddenly interrupts
it's
the broadcast
Kennedy.
And the announcement.
Oh, my God.
Yep, Kennedy had just been shot. And what was interesting is Savalas, he projected that the time he heard the ghostly voice on top of the hill was about 90 minutes prior to when JFK had been shot. So or I'm sorry, no, it was he heard the he heard the broadcast 90 minutes after, but when that time was that he heard the voice, that would have been the exact time that JFK was shot.
Unbelievable. And this is a story he took with him to the grave, isn't it? He believed something weird happened to him.
He did, and he also said, again, on an Australian TV show where he was talking about this experience, he said that there were other encounters that he had had with this voice. I reached out to one of his daughters, Ariana Savalas, but she said she didn't hear anything else about it beyond what I knew already.
But so, she knew about something.
Yeah, maybe. If anyone in the audience knew Telly personally or ever heard directly from him about these other experiences, I'd love to talk with you more about it.
That would be great. Justin, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back and take phone calls with you next. Plus, we'll talk more about some of the UFO stories you've investigated and what you think about the June 25th report from the government. We'll be back.